Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang Gunutarang upacayang namasami. So very auspicious occasion this evening, first activity on this property, and all day it's been very overcast and sticky, and it seemed like it was going to rain, and now the clouds have dispersed. Sitting under the stars, the weather is cool, pleasant breeze, just enough to keep the mosquitoes away, or most of them away. So we've had this opportunity of practicing together and studying and meditating together. And that in itself is a teaching. And it's a teaching that, you know, we're encouraged to believe that pleasure and happiness, contentment, come through consumption, doing things and buying things and enjoying things. And yet, you've been here 2 or 3 days and not eating in the evening and not looking for enjoyments and entertainment, and putting up with some physical discomfort, some more than others. And yet I think, at least as far as I can gather, you all seem to be enjoying it. And this is a simple truth, isn't it? Not a big truth, simple truth. That we have within us the resources to experience contentment. We have a capacity to abandon the unwholesome, develop the wholesome, and purify the mind, purify the heart. And the Buddha once said to the monks, you know, that I'm continually exhorting you to abandon the unwholesome, to develop the wholesome, to purify your heart, is because it is something that you can do. If it was too difficult or if it was impossible, I wouldn't teach you to do it. It's possible. You can do it, and it brings true fulfillment to life. So the Buddha pointed out that we have this very fundamental, very profound desire for permanence. And when we want, we're looking for not just pleasure and happiness, but we want some kind of guarantee of stability. And in romantic movies and plays, and when people declare they love each other, they don't just say, "I love you right now, today. Tomorrow, I don't know." They say, "I love you now, and I'll love you forever." You see. And that's important, isn't it? You know, this is a guarantee. This isn't just a kind of a temporary feeling that might be gone tomorrow. But that we feel this need that that pleasure and happiness is not enough in itself. That we need some kind of guarantee that we can rely on it and that it's stable. And yet, we have to accept that nothing in the world that arises and passes away can provide that stability and that permanence. And this is the root of this teaching of dukkha. And dukkha is really saying, nothing which is impermanent can provide permanent happiness. So if we're aware of the transience and the fragility of happiness that we can experience through the senses, then we can live wisely in the world. But when we are looking for permanence in the impermanent, then we are dooming ourselves to a sense of struggle and impotence and dissatisfaction and discontent, and this constant feeling that there's something not quite right, something not yet. This isn't exactly it. It's somewhere close, but it's not really quite what we thought. So, in Buddhism, we're as I've been trying to emphasize, we're trying to look at life, not imposing ideas upon it, but trying to cultivate our ability to observe and observe the ways that we create problems for ourselves and the way that we can let go of problems. And when we start looking at ourselves, our bodies and our minds and the world around us, what is the one thing that we can say, there's no doubt about this. This isn't just my perception, this isn't just my belief, but this is a universal truth. That is change, isn't it? And there could be no one in the world, surely, whatever nationality, whatever religious faith, whatever philosophy they profess, who can deny this truth of change. But what is our attitude to change? So, maybe 20 years or more ago, there was great excitement about, like a global village, and that through modern technology, we were all going to draw together and have a sense of ourselves as a big human family. And this globalization was going to end all kind of narrow ethnic attachments and rivalries and hatreds and prejudices. And we're going towards this utopian world where we all feel we're in the same boat. And in fact, quite almost the opposite has occurred. And the narrow ethnic rivalries and hatreds have become exaggerated. and everyone with a weird prejudice and hatred and fetish can find like-minded people on the internet in one part of the world or another, and have a little tribe. So the world is becoming more and more tribal rather than less. And the superstitious forms of religion, rather than crumbling away in the face of education and technology, have made use of technology. You see groups like ISIS, who are, their mentality is medieval, but many of them are extremely gifted computer geeks, and they make use of social media in quite skillful ways. So what is behind this? Well, it's obviously too complex a phenomena to make easy judgment. But one thing I would say is that when change takes place rapidly, and when the change is very hard to forecast, and when that change seems to undermine long-held customs and traditions and family structures, then people become very insecure, and they see change as an enemy. And when everything is in flux and everything seems to be threatening you, then the most common reaction is to look for something that doesn't change as a refuge. And the something that doesn't change for most people are the teachings in a holy book. And so through the these feelings of fear of change, being oppressed by change, being threatened by change, people look to hold on to something, anything, as like a rock in this whirlwind or this stream of change. So where as Buddhists do we stand on this? Well, the Buddhist attitude is that we have to understand change. We don't become intoxicated with change and just say, wow, it's everything's moving ahead, it's so modern and so, and we don't resist change as such. But this, the Buddhist middle way is saying we're trying to understand change and to navigate change. And most importantly, we realize that we are change. Our bodies and our minds are change. There's nothing fixed and solid anywhere to be found in the body and mind. One of the ways of talking about this that I like to use is that compared with language, we are verbs. There are no nouns in life, and even the nouns are verbs. So there are no things reacting to other things. The things themselves are verbs, they're processes. So we spoke a little bit this afternoon about this idea of moving away from a thing-based perception of life to a process-based perception. And this isn't just imposing some kind of Buddhist idea, but it's what appears when you look more closely. So one wise monk said that if you some things, the closer you look at them, the more fuzzy and imprecise they become. And those are the illusory things that we are creating through our delusion. Other things, the more closely you look at them, the more clear they become. And those are the things that are true and reliable. So when you see that the very essence of our life is change, then why would you be afraid of change? Why would you react against change as such? So looking and developing the ability to see things in terms of processes, this may sound very abstract and it's difficult to understand, but it's incredibly practical. For instance, looking at other people as things, as fixed, unalterable things, then we make judgments about other people. This is how these like fixed judgments arise. We say Mr. A is a selfish man, or Miss B is a very jealous person, and we so on what basis do you make that kind of a judgment? You have this idea there is this fixed thing, this fixed person called Mr. A, who has this quality called selfishness. Or you have this Miss B, who has this fixed quality called jealousy. And that's a way of looking at people around us, which is deeply deluded. Something that comes up a lot, there's even a very good book written about this, is Why Do Smart People Do Stupid Things? And there's so many occasions where people who are conventionally smart in the sense that they have degrees or even doctorates from famous universities, very high IQ, and yet they do really stupid things. Example from recent history would be, well, so many examples, but Bill Clinton. Now, Bill Clinton is an incredibly smart man, and he'd be given a book in the morning to prep for a meeting in the evening. He could read the book, summarize it, remember most of it, and be able to talk about it in the evening. That kind of smart person. And yet, his behavior with his aide, Monica Lewinsky, couldn't have been more stupid. So why do stupid people, intelligent people, clever people, smart people, do self-destructive and stupid things again and again? My answer to this would be is because we're having this idea of an intelligent person or a smart person. But when we look at it in as a process and see someone as a stream, you can say that there are, over the course of a day, for instance, or over the course, there are intelligent moments, intelligent thoughts, intelligent mental states arising and passing away. And there are also stupid and foolish thoughts, emotions arising and passing away. And it's a complex process, a flow of phenomena. But it's not that there is a smart person who every now and again does stupid things, but there is a human being who contains within themselves the capacity to be both stupid and intelligent according to causes and conditions. And so this movement towards seeing things in terms of causes and conditions is fundamental to this more profound level of right view that we're talking about. You know, not moving away from this idea of seeing people as owners of experience. And so if you see someone who's behaving very badly, then maybe there's this, speaking about this earlier on to one of the retreatants, is this judgment of that person. You know, that's he's a bad person, or he's a selfish person, or whatever. But when you look at it in terms of that, as I feel disgusted, I feel offended by that person and their actions, there can never be any kind of resolution or peace in the mind. But when we are looking inwardly, looking at our bodies and minds, and observing very closely, then we see that on the occasions where we do stupid things, it's not like there is this person, me, who plans ahead and is the architect of my own downfall. What really happens is there's a thought pops up into the mind. There's some stimulus or other. A thought pops up into the mind, and there is an instinctive grasping at the thought. And there is an identification with the thought. That is to say, this is me. This is my thought. And become one with the thought. And the thought multiplies, becomes a story. Or a desire arises in the mind. And then what is a desire? It's just an impulse in the mind. So what happens with that impulse, if you grasp onto that impulse and say, this is my impulse and I've got to act upon this and I cannot not do this, you know, and then you don't want to, and then when thoughts, this is not a wise thing to do, this is a stupid, shut up. I don't want to hear that right now. I don't care about the consequences. I just got to do this, you know. I'll pay the consequences. I'm willing to do that. I really just need to do this right now. And that all consuming kind of passion for something, and it's just this shut up, you know, to conscience and shut up to any kind of rational thought. I don't want to hear that right now. So I would assume that everybody knows what I'm talking about, that in some time in your life, you've had that kind of mental state. Now, when we look at our mind and we recognize how that occurred, that there was a cause and there was a condition, there was a lack of mindfulness, there was a lack of patience, lack of self-awareness, then with all those conditions in place, that desire completely consumed the mind, and we acted in ways which afterwards we felt as deeply ashamed of, or which caused distress to ourselves and others. And when we can see and observe that in ourselves, how there's just this tipping point where there's this moment where it's like the mind wavers, and it's like at that moment there's a crossroads, and there is a moment, a very short moment, and they say, I'm going for it. That's the karmic moment. You know, where there is this very last moment where you could draw back and you don't. You say, I don't care, just go for it. And I would say that we all know that, yeah, just go for it kind of feeling. But when you recognize that, or you've seen it in yourself, then remember that. And then when you see other people acting in bad ways and things, yeah, that's exactly what's happening in their mind. You know, that maybe their threshold is lower than yours, or they have weaknesses in areas that you don't have. But that same kind of impersonal process is taking place. So if we're blaming or criticizing, if we want to do that, then to sort of blame a person for being weak, or a person for being indulgent, or a person for being this and a person that, that's an inaccurate not a clear-sighted view of what's going on. But when we look at it and we're basing ourselves on what we've seen firsthand in our own hearts and minds, then we say, wow, you know, if you don't practice mindfulness, if you're not aware of yourself, it's just so easy for defilement to arise in the mind and make you do these obnoxious things. So can you see, like, the emotional response to that kind of interpretation is very different from saying that, how could he do that? How could she act in that way? That's so awful. And the mind is in turmoil. But when you say, wow, you know, greed, when greed takes someone over someone's mind, oh, just see the damage it can do. When anger colonizes someone's mind, oh, such a terrible things can come out of that person's mouth, and that person could do the most terrible things that they would never dream of doing otherwise because of anger. So you're shifting from seeing persons and people who are agents and oppressors or oppressed or victims, and you're seeing things in terms of the arising and passing away of phenomena. So rather than sounding like a very abstract and intellectual kind of way of looking at things, it just seems, after a while, it says, yeah, but that's exactly what is happening. This idea of a solid, independent entity called Mr. A or Miss B, it doesn't stand up. Just as if we look at our own life, we say, I this, I that, and, you know, and these days, you know, I is such a, you know, a huge, huge thing, and perhaps the most insistent, we are the most insistent, bloated I's in history, I would say. But when we look at this more closely, I, what are we really talking about? You say, I have a backache. What we mean is there is a feeling arising. I remember this. Well, there's a memory arising and passing away. I think. A thought is arising and passing away. I feel. A feeling is arising and passing away. You know, on what grounds are we claiming that there is this owner, this person who feels, this person who thinks, this person who's offended, this person who likes, this person who doesn't like? Certainly on a conventional level, there is. Yeah, and we have to function on that level in everyday life. But that's just one dimension. And we need to enrich that with this more profound dimension, which, as I say, is not some kind of a belief or a philosophical position, but it's something that we can observe very closely. So when you're when you're sitting in meditation and the mind is becoming a little bit calmer, and there's some period of no thinking, and then a thought arises in the mind. Yes. And just see that there's not like the sense of somebody doing this. Where does it come from? Where does that thought come from? You know, it's not you. You didn't will it into existence. And I mean, we have some. There are some English idioms which express this rather well. You know, we say "it occurred to me." That's such a beautiful phrase. It occurred to me, or it dawned upon me. Yeah. You know, there's a wisdom in those phrases that something just arose, and even something that would seem to be most like part of who we are, like a decision, you know. I made a decision after going through the pros and cons very thoroughly, and then I made my decision. But if you look closely at decision in your mind, what really happens? Is it really like that? Quite often, you know, there is this like pros and cons and pros and cons, and then suddenly this a decision just pops up in your mind. You know, it's just like a sneeze. You know, so the most kind of uncontrolled and obviously random kind of thing like a sneeze is actually subjectively not that much different from the most considered mental object like a decision. So, you know, so many people get so tense and stressed out in trying to control things. You know, so why is it so important to control things? Because we feel frightened and fearful of change, that maybe things are going to change in a way that makes us suffer. But the idea that you can control things, is that really valid? How much can you control? What in your life can you control? Like Ajahn Chah would speak in a very down-to-earth way, like say, okay, this is your body. Yeah, is it? So the idea, you know, where is the essence of ownership? What does it mean to say you own something? Well, you may have a piece of paper, like a legal proof that you own something. You own a piece of land or something. But the essential feature of ownership is power and control, isn't it? So if you have a piece of land, let's say on a conventional level, and you have a land deed, you can decide to keep that land deed or you can decide to sell it. It's yours, conventionally speaking. That means you can do with it more or less what you want. But can we say the same about our body? And so Ajahn Chah said, well, can you tell your body not to get old? Can you tell it not to get sick? Can you tell it not to die? Well, you can't. So in what sense are you the owner of your body? Well, you have certain, there's like a window of opportunity. There are certain things you can do to keep in good health, eat well, exercise, sleep well, and so on. But that doesn't mean now you have a right to good health. I've seen over the years, I've seen this people who, you know, like fitness fanatics or yoga fanatics or whatever, you know, so it's really, and then they get ill. And there's something like, it's not fair, you know, I shouldn't get ill. You know, I look after my body so well. You know, I don't eat junk foods, I sleep well, I eat well, I do the exercise, therefore I should be healthy. But it doesn't, I mean, you're increasing your chances, and it's a wise way of treating your body, certainly, But there's no guarantees. It's not as simple as that. And so feeling, you know, do you own your feelings? To what extent are feelings who you are? Are they, you know, and again, simple. Well, if you were, if feelings were really who you are, really yours, then you could just decide, yeah, no more unpleasant feeling. I'm just going to have pleasant feeling. I don't feel pleasant feeling. Come right now, please. I want a pleasant feeling. You can't do that, can you? So looking at the mind and body, you realize, yeah, what kind of control do you have? You know, you're looking to control other people and things around you and situations, and you don't actually have any control over you, the person who's trying to control things. You don't even know what that you is anyway. So as you develop this practice of meditation, with this open-minded observation, then some of your most cherished kinds of beliefs and superstitions about life and about who you are start to crumble. So I was saying in the talk, you know, this incredible kind of arrogance people say about the real world. You know, yeah, okay, you know, you may be able to hack it in a monastery or a meditation center, but what about when you get back into the real world? Well, what is that real world? You know, and nobody's even considered what that means. So the effort is to be training the mind in order to be able to see more and more clearly. And there is a reordering, a natural reordering. Your priorities just change naturally, not because like a good Buddhist should be like this and should be like that. But it's just your values start to shift, sometimes very gradually in a very natural, organic way, but things that formerly seem very interesting and exciting don't seem so interesting and exciting, and things that you would in the past never have thought could give you any pleasure or happiness can. I mean, probably when you're in your teens, you know, the idea of getting up early in the morning and sitting cross-legged on the floor and eating one meal a day is all, you know, never. Why would you want to do that? I want to go to a party, so you can have a choice. You know, you can sit on the hard ground in the dark, or just a kilometer away. There's heavy rock music and lights and alcoholic drinks. And why would you choose to sit here? You know, if you're a teenager, you think it's crazy. But this is how the values change, one through age, of course, but also through looking more clearly and not just believing what the culture and the, you know, advertisers tell you will make you happy, but really observing your mental states. And and you find, for instance, that even menial jobs can be a great source of satisfaction. So, you know, we have this kind of prioritization in society that people who work with their brains or sitting in front of a screen, you know, are working on a higher level than people who are working in the fields in doing manual labor. But if you go to a monastery, what is the kind of work that monks and nuns do? You know, sweeping, cleaning, polishing, basically manual labor, because it's that much easier to be mindful when engaged in manual labor than in jobs where you have to be answering phones and doing this and doing that, like 100 different things at once, which has been given the very kind of grand title of multitasking, which is basically confusing your mind and creating unnecessary agitation. So you can find that simple things in your daily life that you maybe just think these are things to get over and done with before you get into the real world. Things like having a shower, brushing your teeth, getting dressed, cleaning up, or even cooking and putting on your shoes. And all these things, they're kind of, you know, just stuff that you have to do every day in order to get to the real business of life. But so the Buddha is saying, why is one thing more important than another? On what grounds? And why is what you consider to be the real world more important than brushing your teeth? And brushing your teeth actually is probably, you know, it's very important, isn't it, brushing your teeth? But so we have these very pithy kind of Zen-style teachings, you know, when you're brushing your teeth, just brush your teeth. When you're showering, just shower. And when you're getting dressed, just dress, just getting dressed. Now, this sums up this approach. And so giving respect and attention to the small details in life, and not just what are you doing this? Oh, I'm doing this so I can do that. Yeah, what do you want to do that for? Well, I've got to do that until I can do this. So this idea of you're always doing something in order to be doing something else afterwards. So you know, where is the fulfillment in that? If you can change that attitude and say, yeah, this is every bit as important as everything else. Getting up in the morning and going to the bathroom and brushing your teeth and showering and dressing, and these become practices in themselves, you know, to do them and to keep the mind in a wholesome state, and you can find, well, it's really enjoyable. You know, you can really enjoy brushing your teeth or even getting dressed and making your bed and sweeping. And because it's the quality of mind that you bring to the task as much as the task itself. Now, if you're having these small moments of everyday contentment with something as simple and basic as getting dressed, as making the bed, as having a shower, and so on, then you don't have this kind of sense of deficit and sense of need and hunger for some kind of stimulus all the time. So we're always kind of looking for something and anxious and wanting a little bit more and afraid that we're missing out on something. And it doesn't have to be like that. You can just taking one thing at a time and giving that same kind of respect. So in the meditation, you know, meditate, you have to be able to give this same absolute kind of respect to every single breath. Now, it's not, if you're meditating, it's not like, yeah, you're really mindful of this breath, and then you sort of take a rest for a while and think about something and come back and be mindful of a few breaths. And, you know, there are two kinds two kinds of tasks. Probably there are more, but I can think of two at the moment. These are tasks where you can put something down and carry on later. So maybe you're doing a bit of writing, writing an essay or something, or filling in a tax return or whatever it might be. And then you could do it for a few minutes and go off and have a cup of coffee and come back and carry on. no problem. But there's other kinds of tasks where you can't do that. And the classic example given by Ajahn Chah is, you know, the people in the old days before they had matches and lighters, making fire by rubbing two sticks together. And the person, and Ajahn Chah used to do the whole thing. You know, it's really funny, and he's rubbing the stick about, and he's getting weary and sort of bored. And yeah, okay, I'll just put them down for a while and go off and have a cup of coffee and come back and carry on. Well, obviously, this is very different from you know, working on something on your computer where you can go back and after a while and carry on. And something like rubbing two sticks together to get fire, because if you put the two sticks together while you're having your cup of coffee, the sticks cool down and you start again, and you're starting from scratch. So this is the mistake that we often make. That, and the thing with meditation is that continuity and consistency is absolutely key. And some people can get very enthusiastic and, you know, listen to a talk or read a book or meet somebody, and yeah, this is it. I want to go and go to a meditation retreat and just, you know, do this. And they're like really highly motivated. And then off they do it, and they come back, and this kind of let it all dissipate. And then they think, never mind, oh, you know, I'll go to the monastery again. And then after a while, you know, they start to get, people get so negative and start blaming their family and blaming their job. You know, it's like, ah, you know, it's home. It's just so confusing, you know. And I get to the monastery and it's, I just feel so good and feel so peaceful. And you know, sort of blame their spouses or their children or the traffic or whatever it might be. And so you become these kind of retreat junkies, you know, you're just like living for the next retreat. You know, this is obviously not such a wise attitude. And the idea is that you're getting, you know, this is kind of recharging your batteries or really getting you, but you have to be able to carry it on and to apply it back home. Yeah, you can't get the same intensity as you can where you're doing it for some hours a day and you have a supportive conditions. But it's only of value, you know, assuming that you're not in a position to become a monk or a nun, is only of value when you can take this away and find ways of applying it. And just as, say, with the breath, now one of the analogies I say, it's like a doctor with a long line of patients outside his door. And a good doctor will give this absolute care and attention and loving kindness and use all of their abilities with every single patient without discrimination. And every single breath is like the doctor's new patient. You know, superficially seem very, very similar to the previous breath or the next breath, but it's a unique breath. So sometimes in the Thai retreats, you would start this off and say, like today, you know, is the 10th of March, 2018. And this is a very special day because it's the only 10th of March 2018 in history. Yeah, there have been many, many 10ths of March before, but the 10th of March 2018 is absolutely unique. It's never been, and it will never be again. You know, next year it'll be 10th of March 2019. Might be rather similar, but it's not the 10th of March 2018. And now we are on the evening of the 10th of March. And this evening is maybe rather similar to last evening and somewhat similar to tomorrow evening or the evenings of March last year and March next year. But this evening is absolutely unique. Never in the history of the universe has this evening existed. And it will never exist ever again. It's absolutely unique. You know, it's incredible that we've come from all these different countries and we're right here and we're sharing this absolutely unique evening of the 10th of March 2018. And this very minute and this very breath, as you breathe in, that's an absolutely unique experience. You will never have that in-breath ever again. And you breathe out, and you will never have that exhalation, that out-breath ever again. I hope you have many, many more inhalations and many, many more exhalations. But it won't be this one. It won't be exactly the same. Yeah? So, you know, it's absolutely unique. And every single moment of your life, yeah, never happens again. Only happens once. So, you know, although we believe in that, understand there is this process of rebirth, and we've been reborn so many times before, but that can live alongside this insight that, yeah, this is totally unique, every single moment. So when you're brushing your teeth in the morning, yeah, you've brushed your teeth every day, hope, every day throughout your life. But this is the only time today, and this day in history, this teeth brushing is a unique event in human history. and everything you do, yeah. So giving it that kind of attention, interest, and respect. So like respect for the present moment, respect for the every single small detail of your life. And that in itself just bring up a lot of contentment and not necessarily, I need something more than this. You know, we're talking about greed. What does greed becomes from, you know, to my view, essential kind of poverty-stricken mind, you know, that this is not enough. I need something else in order to be happy. And when I get that thing, then I'll be happy. And of course, you get that thing, and it's not quite what you thought. But yeah, but I get something else, and I'll be happy. And there is this very well-known teaching of the Sufi teaching of the Mullah Nasruddin with the big sack of chilies, and he's sitting in front of his house, and he bites a chili off, and it's like, hot, and he takes another one, it's hot, and another one, it's hot. I said, what are you doing? He said, why are you doing that? He says, well, I'm trying to find a sweet one, you see. And this is the idea, you know, well, if you're eating through a sack of chilies, you know, you're not going to find a sweet one. Even if you're very diligent and hardworking and patient and sincere, you're looking in the wrong place. And this idea that, you know, if I just get this this thing, this experience, this object, this, then I'll be okay. You know, it won't. It doesn't work like that. But that's not to say that, you know, don't go after, don't pursue things, but don't pursue those things with the idea that they're going to provide you, they're going to take your suffering away. Because no temporal, no experience can take your suffering away. Now, people even think of like meditation or, you know, spiritual practice as, you know, a technique in order to get the great experience. You know, it's like Satori or, you know, enlightenment. Seeing enlightenment is the ultimate experience, and still, it's still this chasing experience. So meditation is not about getting a special experience and being sort of validated by that, or now I'm a special person because I've had special spiritual experiences that ordinary people don't have. Now I'm something special. So that's just another very worldly like hobby like that, and it's still within the realms of ego. So if you want to gain some special happy state through meditation, then that is, you know, in the language, which we call like wanting to be reborn in heaven, because this is essentially what heaven is. It's like an apparently permanent pleasant experience. And so when meditators are searching for this in meditation, that's very, and when they don't get it, they give up. You know, it's like I've been meditating all this time and I still can't get this kind of pleasant abiding, this peaceful abiding that I want. My mind subs. But the point of meditation is to understand experience, not to gain a certain special kind of experience, but it's to understand the very nature of experience and to be free from identification with experience. So if you're attached to a very refined state of consciousness, then in many ways that is superior to being identified or addicted to a drug or a sensual pleasure. But, you know, in big picture, it's not so different, really. It's the same process of looking to hold on to something and to grasp onto it and try to make it last as long as possible and to feel threatened by separation from it. And so we're looking to see how things arise, how things pass away according to conditions, and realize we don't have to hold on to things. We don't have to grasp onto things. We don't have to push things away in that way. That there is within us this resource of clarity and brightness. And it's just a, now when I first met Ajahn Chah, I can remember not, I just thought, it's not like he's special. It's like he's normal and everyone else is abnormal, you know. Or it's like if you only ever heard people sing out of tune, and then suddenly you heard someone, you know, sing beautifully. Oh, that's what singing's supposed to be. You know, I never knew that before. You know, you realize that everyone you'd ever heard singing before was slightly off key, but because you had nothing to compare it with, you never realized that. And this is what your great masters offer us. It's not like this, this kind of special kind of you know. It's just like, yeah, that's normal, you know. That's how a human being should be, if you like. You know, we're all off key. We're all abnormal. We're all false and distorted. But he or she has proved that we don't have to be like this. You know, there is a path. So there is suffering. Yeah, and we need to look at that very closely and be honest and own up to that. But that suffering's not random. You know, it's not fate. It's not in the stars. It's not due to some original sin. It's right here and right now. Ignorance of the way things are and all the defilements that arise when we don't see the way things are conditioning this suffering. It has a cause, and through following the Buddha's teaching, it has an end. And that we realize our true humanity, we express ourselves most completely and most beautifully When we seek to abandon the unwholesome, develop the wholesome, purify the mind, and realize this freedom, how far we get along this path in one lifetime is irrelevant. It's like once you really see and you accept this, yeah, there is suffering, there is an end to suffering, there is freedom and liberation from suffering through following the Buddha's path, then you don't have any choice. And you think, well, you know, sooner or later, I'm going to have to do this work. If I don't do it today, I've got to do it tomorrow. If I don't do it tomorrow, I've got to do it next week. If I don't do it next week, I've got to do it next month, not next month, next year, not next year, next decade, next lifetime, not next lifetime, the lifetime after that. But sooner or later, I'm just going to have to knuckle down and do this. So why don't I do it right now when, you know, I have this precious human birth and I have the access to the teachings? I have teachers who feel compassion for me and want to share what they know with me. You know, it just makes sense to make the best possible use of this wonderful opportunity that we have. So I would like to share this teaching with you this evening. Thank you. Thank you.